As said, today I speak today not so much on my own account as about the work of David Green, who's Director of the Health and Welfare Unit at the Institute of Economic Affairs. And I base much of my talk on his paper on welfare before the welfare state and his recent book, Reinventing Civil Society, on the rediscovery of welfare without politics. As David Green sees this, there's three main reasons for studying welfare before the welfare state. First, we need to rediscover and explore the various ways of providing welfare services. Second, the West is suffering from a measure of moral breakdown whose roots lie at least partly in the replacement of voluntary associations by the state. Voluntary associations not only provide services, they also serve a vital educational and character-building role indispensable to liberty. Third, we need to improve our understanding of how best to distribute responsibility throughout the community as a bulwark against overmighty government. Organised private welfare fell into two categories, philanthropy and mutual aid. The leading historians of philanthropy have not been able to measure its full extent since it was spontaneous and dispersed. A recent study by Jeffrey Finlayson quotes a contemporary estimate which put the annual expenditure of private charities in London in 1870 as between £5.5 and £7 million, when London contained about 10% of the population. If total charitable giving in England and Wales is put at 55 million, it dwarfs the total expenditure on poor relief in England and Wales of 8 million in 1871. State schooling was introduced in Britain in 1870, but before that date, the Newcastle Commission had reported in 1861 that almost everyone received some amount of schooling at some period or another. Charity schools had mostly been founded during the 18th century to teach poor children the alphabet and the principles of religion. They were followed in the 1780s by the Sunday school movement, which stressed moral teaching as well as literacy and numeracy, and of course the schools of industry, which taught children to be industrious. Voluntary hospitals were also established in London and most of the large towns during the 18th century. Towards the end of that century, the dispensary movement developed to supply medicines and organise district and home visiting in place of hospital attendance. Up to 1948, the voluntary hospitals were providing the backbone of the acute hospital service. Nearly 60% of patients requiring acute care were admitted to voluntary hospitals in 1936. They also provided the overwhelming majority of teaching hospitals. The best source of information is a report by Political and Economic Planning on the British Health Services published in 1937. It was written by socialists who wanted a state hospital service, but they found it necessary to report that in 1935, while unemployment was still high, the voluntary hospitals had an annual surplus income of over £1 million. Voluntary hospitals originally provided free care, but concern grew that it was degrading to rely on charity and movements evolved to allow people to pay. Hospital contributory schemes, a kind of prepaid insurance, developed rapidly during the second half of the 19th century to allow people in lower income groups to make regular contributions entitling them without further inquiry into their means to receive free hospital treatment for themselves and their dependents. By 1936, at least 10 million persons were covered. The record of the voluntary hospitals has a double significance. They had not only been providing improving service for decades, but also provided a focal point for people of goodwill in the locality. Individuals could help as hospital visitors or as fundraisers if that was where their talent lay, or in providing extras like books for patients or running a voluntary canteen. The hospitals, therefore, were outlets for those human decencies, great and small, which made life worthwhile. During the 18th century and until the end of the 19th century, philanthropists devoted themselves to the poor. Sir Frederick Eden's classic study, The State of the Poor, published in 1796, focused on the poor, a term which implied the poor were always with us. It led to the dole charities, which parcelled out aid in cash or kind. By the middle of the century, a new view was beginning to dominate, however, that the problem was one of poverty which could be eradicated. The Charity Organisation Society had been founded in 1869 to campaign against the dole charities, which gave only cash. It felt that this practice had a demoralising effect and pressed for a new approach which sought to restore independence and bring out the best in people rather than to reinforce their dependence. It soon had branches or offshoots in most of the larger towns in Great Britain, the colonies and the United States of America. The problem as envisaged was not of poverty alone. It was also one of social habit, and the challenge was to discover what it was in the background or lifestyle that could be changed in order to restore independence. Indiscriminate relief, as was said, attracts the applicant by an appeal to his weakness, and it requires of him no effort. He preferred to appeal to, so it was better to appeal to the strength of the applicant and to require an effort on his part. I think there is, of course, an acknowledgement here that large-scale poverty subsidies or means-tested or income-related benefits have intrinsic problems which are virtually insurmountable when they're provided on any large scale. And I don't think these are addressed either on the left or the right when the left talks of poverty subsidies or poor relief as of right. And the right itself, conservatives talk, I think, too glibly of targeting benefits without perhaps understanding that that mass means-tested relief has an appalling history in the way that it undermines incentives, breaks down social norms and family structure. It is very difficult to provide relief which doesn't do damage, unless this is on a small and personalised, supervised scale, in which there is some policing of the provision to ensure that it is a step to future independence, rather than it simply sucks people into dependence. The Charity Organisation Society is often presented nowadays, of course, as rather harsh and too quick to distinguish between the deserving and the undeserving poor. But that was not the dominant view. C.S. Loesch put it this way from the Charity Organisation Society. The problem, he said, is not whether the person is deserving or undeserving, but whether, granted the facts, that distress can be stayed and self-support attained. If the help can be given privately from within the circle of the family, so much the better. Sometimes it may be best to advise, but not to interfere. In some cases, but little help may be necessary. In others, again, the friendly relation between the applicant and friend may last for months and even years. The ideal to aim for was mutual respect between giver and taker. And as David mentions, this spirit is captured by an incident in Dickens's Hard Times, when Stephen Blackpool, an honest and hard-working power loom weaver in Bounderby's factory, is unfairly sacked. His plight is desperate, for he has no money and no chance of other work in the locality without a reference from Bounderby. He faces a long and arduous journey by foot in search of employment. Bounderby's wife, who believes her husband was unjust, offers Stephen a banknote to see him through the hard times ahead. He takes only £2, a much smaller sum than she offered, because, he says, he knows he can pay that much back. In other words, despite his dire predicament, he will not allow the relationship to be one-sided and will accept only a loan. Mutual respect between giver and receiver was maintained. But as William Ackroyd, speaking at a gathering of poor law guardians in 1841, maintained, before it is just to say that a man ought to be an independent labourer, the country ought to be in such a state that a labourer by honest industry can become independent. The dominant view here during the 19th century was not that all problems were individual, but rather that a combination of effort by the individual, the community, and the state was required. But when observers emphasised that there must be a common effort, they did not only mean that government must do something. Charities themselves also sought social reform. According to Loesch, the duty of charity was to seek both to intensify the sense of membership of society and also to improve social conditions through legal reform. Shaftesbury, for example, had pushed through the Factory Acts, while others urged prison reform, child protection laws, housing reform, and much more. Moreover, the primary responsibility for welfare in a free society lay with the individual and his family, but no one should be left to cope alone. The community in the form of voluntary association should always be there to help, and the state should be in the background, ready to help, but within proper limits. The emphasis was on responsibility shared between the state, the community, and the individual. And I come to the second half here, mutual aid. The scale of charity was clearly enormous, but it affected far fewer people than mutual aid. 3/4 of those covered by the 1911 National Insurance Act were already members of friendly societies. 9.5 million out of 12 million. Lloyd George, when introducing the bill, argued that it was his intention to make available to everyone the benefits already being provided for themselves by the great majority. In 1910, the last full year before the 1911 Act, there was over 6.5 million members of registered friendly societies, quite apart from those in unregistered societies. The rate of growth of the friendly societies over the preceding 30 years had been rapid and was accelerating. In 1877, registered membership had been 2.8 million, and by 1910, the figure had reached over the 6.5 million mark, having increased at an annual average rate since 1897 for 140,000. Friendly society membership far exceeded that of the other characteristic organisations of the working classes, the trade unions and the cooperative societies. The societies sharply contrasted themselves with charities. Charity was one set of people helping another set. Mutual aid was putting money aside in a common fund and helping each other when the need arose. As one leading society put it, the benefits were rights. For certain benefits in sickness, we subscribe to one fund. That fund is our bank, and we draw therefrom to draw therefrom is the independent and manly right of every member, whenever the contingency for which the funds are subscribed may arise, as freely as if the fund was in the hand of their own banker, and they had but to issue a cheque for the amount. These are not benevolences, they are rights. These other values here included solidarity, a shared commitment to maintain the institutions fundamental to liberty, doing your bit. They emphasised fraternity in the friendly societies, and they provided training and skills necessary for democracy. Offices were shared to give members status and the opportunity to test their talents. For example, the Ancient Order of Foresters did not confine its advice, given during its course of 7 lectures, to the conduct of society business. It also urged new members as follows. In your domestic relationships, we look to find you. If a husband, affectionate and trustful. If a father, regardful of the moral and material well-being of your children and dependents. As a son, dutiful and exemplary. And as a friend, steadfast and true. The common element to all services was independence. Societies provide all the services which enable people to be self-supporting. They provided earnings when the breadwinner was ill or injured, support for the widow and orphans when the breadwinner died, support in old age, although the ethos was different to today. The usual attitude was to keep working as long as possible with the fallback of sick pay. Travelling in search of work, medical care when ill. Usually doctors were paid a fee in return for free care, but the societies also organised medical institutes where service was provided by salaried medical officers. I'd like perhaps to just add a word in relation to my own interests, which lies in the field of the multifarious forms which family policy has taken over time, or rather developed to deal with the problematic position of the family in the competitive waged economy. where those rearing children are always liable to be at a profound disadvantage compared with those who are untrammelled by family responsibilities. Unless, of course, some measures are taken to acknowledge their liabilities and protect family life. Adam Smith had found it almost inconceivable that society would not protect its mainsprings of existence, that it would somehow deliver what he called a natural family wage. Of course, ways in which this was done, like we're quite familiar, I suppose, with gender differentiation in the labour market, unequal pay, which where the responsibilities of the average man as the family provider were recognised in that way. This is, of course, condemned today in terms of the oppression of women or the belittlement of women, but this doesn't take account of the way that it was one attempt to safeguard children of the family in the industrial age. Another way in which family responsibilities were acknowledged was through the kind of provision that David speaks of, that in the life cycle there's periods of heavy expenditure or involuntary restriction of earning power, just like sickness, unemployment, old age. And friendly societies provided for that through the contributions of their members. But there was also a great deal of provision of various family allowance schemes. We find all manner of schemes, whether they were funded through the contributions of employers and employees in particular firms or industries, or indeed in particular trades or professions, or in the friendly societies themselves, where the members made contributions and received in turn allowances at the period of life when they had children to support. And this, of course, prevents the care and support of children and families becoming a factor in impoverishment and pauperisation, and through that, of course, dependence on poor relief, and again with the disincentive structure that that implies. Now, the argument is not that the friendly societies and charities and other voluntary bodies always hit upon better ways of doing things. Many also made mistakes, but this too was valuable. One of the most important lessons of history is that there is no perfection in human affairs. But in allowing many people to back their judgment, we often arrive sooner at the right answers. We learn from the successes and failures of others. Where government assumes our responsibility, it has proven far more difficult to correct errors than it did during the 19th century, when critics did not have to fight a political campaign, but could more readily put their ideas to the test of experience. As in many other things, the undue concentration of power is the enemy of welfare. There's also a more general reason for studying the history of welfare. We urgently need to refresh our understanding of the ideal of a free society. Until the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the 20th century was dominated by the battle between two economic systems, a planned economy and a market economy. The ideal of freedom is not only a free economy, allowing the free play of self-interest, the fluctuation of demand and supply, competition, and favouring private over state-owned property. It is also about encouraging and harnessing the best in people, including the full range of human motivations and ideals. It is about character, virtue, intelligence, measuring up to challenges, facing difficulties. In the fight against communism, the moral dimension has sometimes been forgotten in the heat of the battle. This omission was yet another of the costs of communism, which defined the battle in purely economic terms. Now that communism is out of the way, we need to develop the ideal of liberty further. It should embrace a free economy, the freedom to make money, but also the duties that go with success. Defenders of a free society should acknowledge that a free economy in its own lacks moral credentials without a corresponding philosophy. It is the moralization of society which makes capitalism fit for human consumption. The ideology of communism insisted that the economic base determined the social order, as did milder forms of collectivism, of course. Opponents of collectivism had little option, therefore, but to concentrate their attack on communist economics. But in drawing attention to the merits of markets, some advocates of freedom have lost sight, maybe, of the historic ideal which in reality made Western civilization or liberal capitalism superior to communism. With hindsight, we can now see that the preoccupation with economics diverted our gaze from the deeper questions facing any civilization. People professing moral values are not all closet socialists. The challenge we face today is to identify a sense of community or create a solidarity that is compatible with freedom. Competitive markets coordinate the efforts of people who may be self-interested, even selfish, but they do not create solidarity any more than the state embodies this when it acts, as envisaged by collectivists, as a director of the forces, the impersonal forces which are supposed to control human beings and serve the needs it thinks, or rather rule in elites and interest groups thinks, it can identify better than the people themselves can. It is instead the realm of the common life, common activity, that is at once voluntary and guided by a sense of duty to other people and to a social system on which liberty rests. As Adam Smith recognized, a good society requires more than coordination. Liberty rests on people taking personal responsibility for the maintenance of the institutions, morals, and habits fundamental to freedom. The tradition of communal liberalism is not a utopian ideal of the imagination. It was lived reality for many years, well into the 20th century. I think David's work is an important contribution to describing the day-to-day character of this tradition, by reassessing the voluntary social institutions for mutual aid that emerged under its influence by the end of the last century, and how to understand the character of an historical movement, we must turn not only to the writings of the intellectual leaders, but also to the conduct of the humbler citizens of the land. For liberty was not only an intellectual ideal, it was the guiding philosophy of many common people who acted out its values in their everyday lives and associations.
I think the point was made at an earlier session that we're using the afternoon for promoting books, but I think it's very worthwhile to mention that if you'd like some follow-up reading and the detail on what Patricia's talked about, just mention again the titles of her recent books, Farewell to the Family and Capitalism in the Family, which will be forthcoming sometime. It's not ready yet.
There's
Reinventing Civil Society
is David's book.
Is David Green's book, too, and she has a copy here. That